So that actually is a good example of how to practice mindfulness. Yeah, that it doesn't mean just bear attention on what you're doing. It's we keep mindfulness on our bodhicitta motivation. Yeah, we anchor our mind to that motivation. So that motivation is always, you know, if not manifest in our mind, then latent and easy to manifest in our mind. Yeah. And in that way, we maintain the mindfulness on bodhicitta. Okay. When we have bodhicitta, then there's certain actions we want to do and certain actions we don't want to do. Yeah, because certain actions are conducive to the benefit of all sentient beings and certain actions are the opposite. Okay. And so the bodhisattva vows, the different precepts in the bodhisattva code, ethical code, are like advice that say, okay, when you really have the aim to become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings, do these things and try and avoid these things. Yeah. So it's like an accumulated book of good advice and tips on how to accomplish your aim. Okay, so like I keep saying, don't see precepts and samaya, you know, commitments and things like this as things tying you down, but as things that are showing you how to accomplish what you want to accomplish. Yeah, it's really important, you know, really keep that in mind. So when we think, you know, oh yeah, sentient beings want happiness like me and they want to be free of suffering just like me. And how am I going to accomplish that? You know, well, I've got to become a Buddha because then I won't have all the impediments I have right now. And then I'll have the skills that I don't have right now. So what do I need to do to become a Buddha? Yeah, tell me how to do it. So that's what the teachings are all about. And then the Bodhisattva Ethical Code is the real practical advice about pay specific attention to these kinds of actions and the motivations that lie behind them. Because if you get involved with them, you're going to be going opposite to the direction that you want to go it to. Okay? So, yeah, it's like, you know how in magazines they have, you know, 18 tips for a better life. So we have, yeah? So we now have 18 tips to become a Buddha. You know, 18 major tips and, you know, 46 minor tips. And you know, that makes a good magazine article, you know, the kind of bright red letters on the head and some sexy person on the front. And then everybody might, you know, follow the bodhisattva path. Wouldn't that be nice? But, okay, minus the sexy person on the front, you know, we're going to really be exploring, you know, what these tips are. You know, that will lead us in the direction that we want to go in. Now, what's interesting, I want to explain a little bit about the three different ethical codes in the Nalanda tradition. Yeah, because we have the Pratimoksha, or individual liberation ethical codes, the Bodhisattva ethical code, and the Tantric ethical code. Sometimes these are called the three sets of vows, but they aren't really vows, so they're really more like ethical codes or sets of ethical restraints. So in the Pratimoksha, what the individual liberation, that's where we have the five lay precepts and your eight anagarika precepts and the novice monks and nuns precepts and so on, and the Shikshamana precepts. Those are all part of the individual liberation ethical code. And all of those precepts you take from somebody. You know, you take from a preceptor, yeah, or you take from the Sangha. And so there you take those in the presence of somebody. Yeah. And those different sets of Pratimoksha precepts or individual liberation precepts came about we could say by necessity or by trial and error. In other words, when the Buddha was alive, actually for the first 12 years, the Sangha didn't have any precepts because nobody did anything that was terribly obnoxious. Yeah, and then when people started doing things that were kind of offensive or unethical, then based on real life events, then the Buddha made different precepts and say, avoid this and, you know, things like that. So that's how we got the five precepts, how we got the monks and nuns precepts, and so on. Yeah, it was because specific individuals did naughty things. So there's the group of six monks and the group of six nuns, and they say that due to the kindness of these 12 naughty individuals, we have the precepts we have. Yeah, there's one nun in particular, Stulananda, again and again, oh, I can't believe this person. You know, I mean, it in some way she might very well be a caricature, but she might also be a real person. But boy, you know, was she getting into stuff? And there was the same things with the monks, you know, who were always doing one thing or another. And so this is, you know, how those precepts evolved. Yeah. And so the Buddha, you know, would establish them when news of a certain naughty action came to his ears. And then sometimes, you know, he would say something and then a different situation would come up and he would have to adjust it more or less for that different situation. You know, you don't do this unless in these circumstances, then you can do it. Okay? And so each of our monastic precepts has a story behind it, and then stories that made the exceptions, and so on. Okay, so that's the first level of precepts, and to take those, then you take refuge in the three jewels, and then at that time you also have the opportunity to take the five lay precepts, and that really sets the ground for your practice. Yeah, because sometimes I've described the practice in terms of three levels of stop being a jerk. Yeah, because a Buddha's not a jerk. So, you know, there's three levels of practice to stop being a jerk. So the first one is, you know, let's get our everyday ethical, you know, material together so that we're stop being like a super big jerk by killing and stealing, using our sexuality unwisely and kindly, lying and taking intoxicants. You know, a bare bones that, and then as manifestations of that, all the hundreds of other precepts that the monastics have. Okay? So that's the first thing we do to like really stop being a jerk. Yeah. And you can see it. I mean, look at the people that you've known in your life. Who are the people that bug you the most? Yeah, jerks. And what do the jerks do? They kill. They take what hasn't been given to them. Yeah. They sleep around and flirt and do all sorts of unbecoming things. Then they lie about everything they do, yeah, and speak harshly to others, and then they get loaded and their behavior is completely uncontrolled. Yeah? I mean, look at it. You know, when we think of ourselves, it's like, that's hard. But think of the people you know, the people you least want to be friends with. You know, they're the people who do these five things. Yeah? And every religion, you know, agrees. I mean, except the Catholics who make the alcohol. But no, I'm joking. They do. They do, and the monastics are allowed to drink in that tradition. Yeah, I find it amazing. Yeah. Okay, I better be quiet now. okay. But you can see in Islam, you know, not supposed to drink. You know, for the same reason, people just get crazy when they do. Yeah. So that's the first level. Yeah. Then the second level is the bodhisattva level, okay? The first level, we're trying to, you know, control our own behavior and not create the cause for a bad rebirth. In the second level, we're really trying to work for the benefit of others. Yeah. And so then, first you generate the aspiring bodhicitta, which is when you aspire, you know, to aspire to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings, but you're not committing to do it yet, okay? So you just, you have that aspiration. And so for the group that was here for the earlier six session teachings, we went through the precepts of aspiring bodhicitta, you know, which are designed to help you not give up your bodhicitta in this life and also in future lives. Then when you've progressed a little bit more and you say, well, I really want to, you know, engage in the bodhisattva path and really practice it, then you have what's called engaging bodhicitta, and then you take the bodhisattva vow, the bodhisattva ethical restraints. Okay, so aspiring bodhicitta is like wanting to go to Dharamsala, and engaging is like getting your ticket and your visa and getting yourself to the airport and on the plane, okay? So you can see there's a difference in commitment there. Yeah, so there's a difference in your practice as well. Okay, so that's in terms of the bodhisattva, ethical conduct. And those, well, I'll say that afterwards. Then on top of that, on the basis of your individual liberation and your bodhisattva practice, then you enter the Vajrayana, and at that time when you take initiation into the upper two tantra classes of yoga and highest yoga tantra, then you take the tantric ethical code and also the samaya, the commitments, the pledges. Okay? And so those, when we look, there's an increasing scale of difficulty, yeah. Because with the pratimoksha ones, you know, you start with the five lay precepts and the monastic precepts, and that already can be difficult. Then the bodhisattva precepts are more difficult, and the tantric precepts are even more difficult to keep, because each set is making our mind more and more refined, and making us more and more aware of our behavior. Okay? So that's why the increasing difficulty. So also with our individual liberation precepts, to break those, you have to either do something or say something. Okay? So of course your mind is involved, and the mind is going to determine a lot of, you know, whether, you know, the action and how heavy it is and if you actually completed it and so on. But you actually have to do something or say something for the pratimoksha precepts, okay? So those are precepts that really govern actions of our body and speech. They relate to the mind, but you can't break them just by the thoughts you have in your mind. You cannot commit a full transgression just by the thoughts. Okay, because the mind is the root of everything. First the mind goes, then the speech, then the body. Yeah. So in practicing restraint, we start with the grossest and the easiest to concern, which is our body, then our speech, and then the most difficult to restrain is our mind. Okay, because we can see that. Are you getting what I'm saying? I mean, before you say something, something's going on in your mind. And before you punch somebody or pat them, something else is going on in your mind. Okay, so the mind is the source of the verbal and physical actions, okay, that are restrained by the individual liberation precepts. Okay, the bodhisattva precepts, some of them regard what we do, some of them also regard what we say, and some of them you can break just by thinking, just by your thought alone. So you can see there it's much more refined, okay? Because it's really getting us to look much more at what our thoughts are, what our motivations are, what kind of mental factors are manifest in our mind at the time what kind of emotions we have that are motivating us to do something. Okay? So that's what I said, when they're more refined and they're more difficult to keep. Then the tantric precepts and commitments are even more difficult because those have a lot more to do with mind. You know, some with body and speech, but a lot to do with our mind. Okay? So then again, they're much easier to break. And also because of the way that we're the kind of mental actions that we're becoming aware of with the tantric precepts are much, much more subtle than with the bodhisattva precepts, which are much, you know, more subtle than the individual liberation or pratimoksha precepts. Okay? Now, in these three sets of ethical codes, before you take them, you're not really supposed to know, like the monastic precepts. Nowadays, you know, people often read something, but technically speaking, you're not supposed to fully know them before you take them. And also the tantric precepts, you know, like I said, nowadays many people read them, but you're not actually supposed to know what they are before you take them. The bodhisattva precepts are different. There's an exception. Those were really encouraged to learn and to learn about even before we take them, and to even, you know, practice as if we had them in order to help us, you know, reaffirm to cultivate that bodhicitta motivation. Okay, so that's why, like when there's teachings on the Vinaya precepts or the tantric precepts, they're only open to the people who have them, but the bodhisattva precepts, they're open to everybody. With the individual liberation precepts, if you transgress a root precept completely, with all the factors in you know, complete, then you've lost that ordination and there's no way to retake it. Okay? So, for example, monks and nuns, we have different amounts of root precepts, and if we break any of those with all the different branches complete, then we're no longer monastics and we can never reordain in this life. Yeah? With the other categories of precepts that aren't the root ones, if we break those, and those are the ones that we confess and restore on the posada days, like when we did the confession and restoration here, okay? So those, or if we've done, you know, some of the major ones but not fully, yeah, then those we restore in the presence of the Sangha and making confession and purification. And sometimes you get some kind of, you know, the Sangha gives you something to do to kind of give you space to think about what you've done and, you know, and decide if you really want to humble yourself and come back and be a part of the community again. Okay? But if you break those completely, then finished. Yeah? With the bodhisattva precepts, if we break the root ones completely, we lose the ordination, but it is possible to retake it. Okay? And the same with the tantric, you know, precepts and so on. So there's different methods to retake them. With the bodhisattva ethical code, you know, we can retake it in front of a teacher, or we can also do it on our own. And so actually, once you've taken the bodhisattva precepts, we're supposed to take them on our own every morning and every evening. So for those of you who are doing the sixth session yoga, you can see that there's a verse particularly for that, yeah, so that you fulfill that commitment when you do your sixth session, okay? And so in that way, you are renewing your bodhicitta, you know, ethical code or ethical restraints on a daily basis and strengthening them by, you know, retaking them every morning and every evening. Yeah. For the tantric precepts, although we have a prayer kind of in which we imagine retaking them and go through the precepts and through the commitments, the samaya for the five dhyani buddhas. We're not really retaking it when we just do that as part of our daily sadhana, our daily practice. It's certainly imprinting it more in our mind, but we're not really retaking them and purifying. To really do with the tantric precepts, then if you do 100,000 vajrasattva, then you can purify transgressions to the tantric precepts. Or once you've done the retreat on that deity with a certain number of mantra and the fire puja that concludes the retreat, then you can do the self-initiation and you can retake the tantric ethical restraints at that time. Or you can retake the initiation with a master, and at that time you also retake all your tantric precepts and commitments. Okay? So with each of these levels of precepts, there's some similarities, but also some differences according to taking them and how they came about and what constitutes a break and so on and so forth. Okay? So we'll be getting into that. While the monastic precepts of individual liberation were created due to the kindness of these naughty monastics, the bodhisattva precepts weren't organized as an ethical code from the very beginning. Rather, what happened is there was different bodhisattva advice sprinkled throughout the Mahayana sutras. And then it was brought together. And so, let me make sure I explain this correctly. Okay. So, So Arya Sangha, he was one of the great Bodhisattva scholars, practitioners. He lived from 4th century. Then he accumulated a lot of the advice from different Mahayana sutras into his ethics chapter of a text called the Bodhisattva Grounds or Bodhisattva Bhumi. Okay? So he also wrote another text called the Shravaka Bhumi, the Hearer's Grounds, and he gives a lot of information about meditation in there and a lot of the practices common to all Buddhist practitioners. But in the Bodhisattva Grounds, he's really focusing on, people who want to practice the Bodhisattva vehicle. And so in the ethics chapter, then he detailed 4 major transgressions and then 46 minor ones or auxiliary ones. And Chandragoman, who was a layperson, but a bodhisattva, who was also at Nalanda University, I believe, then he condensed Asanga's elaborate explanation into a short text called The 20 Verses on the Bodhisattva Ethical Restraints. Okay, so he condensed the 4 major and the 46 auxiliary ones. Okay, then Asanga had said in his text to the readers to also go through the rest of the Mahayana scriptures and see what other kind of advice the Buddha put in them for what to practice and what to avoid, as a bodhisattva. And so Shantideva, the author of Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Deeds, he did just that. And so he wrote a text called the Shikshasamuchaya, or Compendium of Trainings. And here he compiled a list of 14 major transgressions, okay, that were based on the Akashagarbha Sutra. Now, one of the 14 transgressions from Shantideva's list was the same as one of the root ones in a Sangha's list. So that brings us to 17 root. So where did the 18th one come from? So Shantideva got it from another sutra called the Sutra for Skillful Methods. So the 18th Bodhisattva root precept came from the Sutra for Skillful Methods. Okay? So that's how we got this ready-made list of 18 plus 46. It's not like the Buddha said, okay, here they are, and went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay? But rather they were collated over time, you know, and to make the list that we have now. So what I wanted to do is go through these, and I was going to do it by reading from Dakpo Rinpoche's commentary, because he referred to Asanga and Chandragoman and Shantideva and so on, and gave like a commentary on each of these. So I thought to read it, and then we can just kind of discuss it as we go through it, and you know, and then after each time, to go back and in your meditation think of some examples in your life that apply to these, you know, the different precepts as we go through them. Okay? So the first one, Chandragoman says, out of attachment to gain and honors, praising yourself and belittling others. Okay? So Dakpo Rinpoche says, the first major transgression of the Bodhisattva vows consists of praising oneself and denigrating others out of attachment to material gain or to marks of respect. So you can see here it's for a specific purpose. Yeah? It's like, I want something out of somebody. I want them to think I'm wonderful. I want them to, you know, bow down to me, or be my little groupies that follow me around, or, you know, praise me to other people. And I'm kind of jealous of this other teacher who has a good reputation, and I don't want people to follow them. So I disparage them and show how what I'm, you know, I'm a much better practitioner and my teachings are much better. And, you know, it's called kind of having a big ego. But there's so many subtle ways to do this, in which you don't look like you have a big ego. Yeah. Yeah, we're very skillful at this kind of thing, you know? How to appear humble, but at the same time promote ourselves in a selfish way. We know how to do it. Okay, so so the great way, which was Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary on the Bodhisattva ethical code, he says, from three angles, the object, the word spoken, and the motivation, the meaning becomes clear. So in looking at this precept, we're going to look at the object, who is the person spoken to, the contents of the words that were said, and the motivation behind the words. Okay. So the first aspect, the object, is always a person other than ourselves. In other words, if we talk to ourselves, we may commit a misdeed, but never a major transgression. Okay? So that means, you know, if we sit here and go, oh, I'm so much better than that other person. Let's see, I want everybody to follow me and not them. You know, if you're sitting there kind of talking to yourself, instead of saying Vajrasattva, your lips are moving, but that's what you're saying. Okay. So that's a misdeed. We're not saying it's karma-free. It's a misdeed, but it's not a major transgression. Furthermore, the person we address must be capable of hearing and understanding what we say. He must therefore be of the same kind, or in other words, a fellow human being. Okay, speaking to either an animal or a being belonging to another realm of life does not qualify. Okay. She probably knows all sorts of secrets about all of us. Okay, so the transgression is not complete by talking to ourselves alone in a room or talking to a dog or a cat. Okay, and then the second aspect was the content of the words that are spoken. And so we may proclaim good qualities that we do not have, or at least that we don't have to the extent that we do. Okay, or we disparage others and deny the good qualities that they actually possess. Okay, so the transgression, therefore, involves misrepresenting the truth, either through an outright lie or by simple exaggeration. It is also necessary that the object of our scorn has excellent qualities and be generally respected for them. It is someone held in esteem and trusted by others. Okay? So here he's getting really into the details. You know, it needs to be somebody of high esteem, and you need to, have a certain motivation, and it's a distortion of the truth. Yeah? But it's still good. So even though these are kind of technical points that make it actually much more difficult to break it, to think of the times when we put ourselves up and put others down, and it's, you know, it's not necessarily through lying or exaggerating. It's really, you know, telling the truth, but telling the truth in a very special way, okay, with a very special motivation. Yeah, like that person doesn't know what they're talking about. So this precept is particularly given in a Dharma context, you know, because it's very easy if you get into a position of being a leader in a Dharma center or, you know, leading meditations or discussion groups or giving Dharma talks to kind of, you know, you want to hold on to your students, yeah, because they're the ones that give you the respect and they're the ones who give you offerings. And you don't want them going to somebody else because then your livelihood is at stake. Okay? So this is the kind of thing that a Dharma practitioner could very easily do. Now, although it, you know, may be focused particularly on that, surely in so many other aspects of our life, we can do it too. I mean, even you're working at a job, there's ways of putting yourself up and putting the other person down. You know, either by lying or exaggerating, or sometimes not by lying and exaggerating, but with this very conniving motivation, because I want to get something out of it. I want my boss to give me, you know, this new opportunity or the promotion. I want the raise. I want to be able to travel at the job. I want to be, you know, captain of the team or whatever it is. Okay? So it can apply to other things as well. Yeah, it sounds really awful when applied to Dharma situations, but, you know, that's why we need these kind of precepts to protect us. Because just because, you know, we're Dharma practitioners doesn't mean that all the rubbish is gone from our mind, as you see by one day in retreat. Yeah, it becomes abundantly clear, doesn't it? Okay. So the third aspect, the motivation, is attachment to either material goods or honors. Okay, it is not necessary to crave both, however. One is enough. So in the first case, the goods we desire must belong to someone other than ourselves. They must not be communal property, for example, a house owned collectively with other members of our family. And this principle does not apply to attachment to honors, because clearly honors aren't owned in the same way. Therefore, if we praise ourselves or belittle someone else out of longing for signs of respect from our parents, for example, we commit a major transgression. Okay, now think of that in relationship to your brothers and sisters. Do you sometimes praise yourself and put them down because you're wanting praise and approval from your parents, or because you want to be on your parents' good side, you know, and maybe they'll give you a little bit more money in their will or whatever, or forget the will, who waits that long, maybe they'll give you some cash right now. Yeah? I mean, when you live in your parents' house until you're 40 nowadays, why not? Okay, but, you know, so you know, I think that's an interesting example there, yeah, putting ourselves up and putting somebody else down to gain our parents, you know, respect or praise or to get something out of them. And the same way to our employer, yeah, the same way, you know, to somebody if you're trying to attract somebody to yourself you know, but they're also dating somebody else, then of course, you know, put myself up and put them down. Okay? Because you want that person to like you and respect you and stuff like that. Okay. However, it is legitimate to praise ourselves with the idea of acquiring material goods when we attend to use them for a good purpose, such as making offerings to the three jewels or helping the needy. Okay? Since it is not done for the sake of personal profit prompted by attachment, there is no transgression. So here, if you speak about your good qualities, you're not going to be exaggerating them or making up ones that you don't have. But, you know, if somebody needs some money for, you know, doing a Dharma retreat or making offerings, or, well, actually the Dharma retreat could be more for yourself, but you want to make offerings or you want to, you know, maybe go somewhere to help at a certain temple or center or something, you know, and so it needs support for that. Then to say what you've been doing so that, you know, you're worthy of that support, that's completely okay, because you're not exaggerating. And like I said, it's not so much your support. You need the money to you know, because you want to make offerings or you want to help or something like that. So that's okay. So I'm thinking, for example, you know, like we've gotten involved in the youth emergency services in Newport, you know, with trying to help the homeless teens in our area. Yeah. And so if we speak about the good things that the Abbey is doing to people in the attempt to raise some money for the youth emergency services, then that wouldn't fit into it because it's not for our own personal gain. Okay? Or if we tell what the good qualities and the things that the Abbey's doing because we're trying to build Chenrezig Hall and we're not exaggerating or, you know, making up things, then that's also okay because that is not for personal gain. Yeah, that's for the benefit of actually most of the guests. Yeah, if it was just the people at the Abbey, we don't need to build that big building. Yeah, so that's mostly for the guests. So, you know, to really let people know, and then they, you know, so that's completely okay. Yeah. But what we want to avoid here is just this very egotistical thing of, you know, I'm so great, and, you know, don't trust them. The quality of their teachings is lousy, and, you know, they're this and this and this and this. And it's made up and it's done out of this very corrupted motivation. Okay? So again, that's also going to be different than warning somebody of a teacher who is doing controversial things. Okay? If you say to somebody, oh, such and such, you know, somebody says, well, I'm thinking of going to teachings by so-and-so, and you know that there's been, like, so much stuff on the internet about so-and-so and their behavior, then you might say, you know, just be aware that that person's quite controversial and you might want to really, you know, investigate very carefully before you get involved. So that's okay to say because that's done out of care and concern for the other. It's not out of attachment to yourself to get that person to follow you or to give you something or like that. Okay? So it's very good to think of different examples here and really know very in detail what these details are, because otherwise we might get very confused and think that, you know, we shouldn't at all speak of our own good qualities, even in situations where people ask us to, you know, tell them the good things that we're doing or whatever, okay? Because they like to feel inspired and they want to know, and then we think, oh, I'm going to break a precept doing that. So, you know, that's why we need to know the precepts well, so that we don't hold back unnecessarily, and so that we don't speak, you know, out of a really rotten motivation and to others in our own detriment. Okay? The motivation has yet another aspect. Our words must stem not only from attachment, but from jealousy as well. There's no reference to jealousy in either the ethics chapter from a Sangha or in the 20 verses on the Bodhisattva vow by Chandragoman. However, Shantideva, in his compendium of trainings, names jealousy as a further requirement for the motivation, referring directly to the Akasagarbha Sutra for this information. Therefore, to commit the first transgression, not only must we be attached to goods or to signs of respect, but we must also be jealous of people's excellence, such as their nice belongings or others' consideration for them. Because we cannot bear the thought that they enjoy these, we exaggerate our own good qualities and denigrate the people in question who are respected by others. Okay? This is done either in the hope of gaining some material benefits, gifts, cash, food, clothes, means of transportation, and so on, or because we yearn for signs of others' respect for us, good seats, distinctions, tributes, you know, people doing all sorts of things for us so that we can just, you know, stride in and feel very important. Furthermore, the people we speak to must be capable of hearing and understanding what we say. In fact, we cannot speak scornfully direct. In fact, we can speak scornfully directly to the worthy person we disdain, or to someone else who respects that person. So you can say right to the person themselves, or to somebody else. When all these conditions are fulfilled and the four binding factors are present as well, the first major transgression is effectively complete. We'll get into the four binding factors a little bit later, but they're listed in the book there. You can read them. Okay? Then the second one is, Chandragoman says, to those in distress who lack a protector out of miserliness, not giving wealth or dharma. Okay, so the second transgression of the Bodhisattva vow is made by refusing to share the wealth or the knowledge of the dharma that we possess. To better understand the meaning of this transgression, we will investigate its following objects. So first, here the object, or the petitioner, the person who's asking. Second, the substance requested. Third, the subject who receives the request, us. And fourth, the motivation. Is this working, or are you relying on me? Is that plug? That's not working. So you're relying on me, okay? Because I can feel that I'm starting to speak too loud, and my voice is going. So maybe I'll speak a little bit softer if you can't hear me in the back row, then say something. Because my voice will last longer if I don't speak so loud. Okay, so the object is a petitioner with particular traits who is seeking wealth or spiritual instruction. As Acharya Chandragoman specifies in his 20 verses on the Bodhisattva vow, it is those in distress who lack a protector. Okay, so somebody who's really in distress, who doesn't have somebody else to turn to, that's the person who's asking us for either material goods or for dharma instruction. Thus, the petitioners must be truly in need. They may be hungry and have nothing to eat, have no clothes to wear, or no roof over their head. Furthermore, they must have no other recourse but us. They must not have any family or friends or someone to guide them that they feel they can trust. In other words, when people are in need materially or spiritually, but have the possibility of appealing to someone else for assistance, there is no fault in refusing their request. Okay? The same two conditions apply to spiritual instruction. The people must have no one else to whom they can turn for the teachings and they are specifically seeking. And they must be completely dependent on us for them and place all their hopes in us. Okay. And the final point regarding the petitioner is the way that they make their appeal. It must be done sincerely and properly, which is to say according to religious and social conventions. Okay. So if somebody comes up and just says, hey, give me this, you know, that's kind of not a proper request. Or if you know that the people have somebody else that they can also rely on, then if you refuse, it's okay. Of course, if they've already checked with all those other people and at this point they really don't have anybody else to rely on, then it's another situation. Okay. And then the substance, so the second aspect requested, may be one of two kinds, material goods, money, food, clothes, and so on, or spiritual instruction. Okay, so somebody's asking for one of those two things. An exception is made regarding a request for dangerous substances, such as weapons, poisons, or anything else that the person could use to physically harm himself or others. There is no fault in refusing these, or for that matter, any spiritual instruction that potentially, through misuse, could damage the petitioner or other people. This can be quite complicated in the present context of social or medical assistance. For example, when a drug addict appeals to us for illegal substances or for funds to purchase them, we may wonder, should we or shouldn't we provide them with this? Yeah? Because, you know, bodhisattva, you think, give everybody whatever they ask for. You know, we're supposed to be generous. Somebody asks, they really need, you know, so we should give them the money to go buy their drugs or alcohol or go get it for them or whatever. So somebody could be thinking like that. In bodhisattva practice, the answer is found in terms of true criteria, temporary and long-term benefits. Providing addicts with drugs in most cases will provide a short-term benefit. The user will momentarily be satisfied. On the long term, however, drugs are harmful, and for that reason, we will not supply users with them. Okay? So very clear. Yeah, somebody comes up, you know, I mean, sometimes this can happen from a family member who's drinking or drugging. It can happen, you stop at a gas station and somebody comes up and asks you for something. I remember in Washington, D.C., when we were going for the Kala Chakra, I was walking to the stadium one day, whatever it was, and somebody asked me for something, and I like to give food, so I was handing him food, and he didn't want that. Yeah? So then I said, well, I'm sorry, you know, I don't. Yeah, I'm a nun. Yeah. Because I don't want to give somebody something that could be used for something else. Now, of course, they could be using it for transportation or a place to stay. I don't know. But in that kind of situation, I don't want to take the chance. And I figure food is always something nutritious. Okay. The long-term effects override the temporary benefit. Conversely, if something carries a temporary drawback but an ultimate advantage, it should be furnished. Okay? So we're always thinking here in terms of our generosity and basically in terms of any choices we make in our life, what's the short-term benefit and what's the long-term benefit? Okay? If something is of neither benefit in the long-term or the short-term, don't do it. If it's in benefit in the long term and the short term, do it. Okay? If it's not beneficial in the short term, but it is beneficial in the long term, do it. But if it's not beneficial in the short term, but it is, if it is beneficial in the short term, but not in the long term, don't do it. Okay? So always, you know, this is a very helpful criteria when we have decisions to make in our life. Yeah, really look long-term, you know, and especially when we're looking long-term, not just the criteria of what material or reputation gain will I get in the long-term, but what about my ethical conduct in the long-term? What about my bodhicitta practice in the long-term? Okay, which situation, yeah, is going to be most conducive for my developing in the way that I want to develop? Yeah, in the long term. An adequate subject is a person who has the possibility of giving the substance that is sought. because he has them or has the possibility of procuring them. So we're the subject. Somebody's asking us for something. To commit a transgression, we must have received a request for a form of wealth or a teaching that we have in our possession and yet refuse to give. It is easy to understand that if we don't have what is asked of us, there's no fault in refusing it. Okay. The motivation behind the refusal is miserliness. So here too, looking at a specific motivation. Yeah, it's miserliness. We incur the second transgression when out of stinginess, we decide not to share the harmless belongings or the Dharma teachings that were requested of us. In addition, for the fault to occur, it is not necessary that the petitioner be aware of our refusal. Okay, so we don't have to say no directly to their face. We can wiggle out of it. We might wonder whether we contravene the precept when we do not give money to charities that solicit our financial support for projects in the third world, for example. Okay. So before I tell you his thought on this, what do you think? Do you think that fulfills the criteria of that given so far?
No.
No, why not? Yeah, there's other places to go. Okay. It seems unlikely that refusing donations to charities constitutes a transgression of the Bodhisattva precepts, but to check, we must consider each aspect of the transgression. So the first requirement is the person be truly in need. The second is that he has no one else to turn to for assistance. This suggests some kind of personal contact and a personal approach. The procedure in fundraising for charities is far from personal, and the soliciting charity itself is not in need. Okay. Moreover, fundraising campaigns are often organized to help large groups of people, even entire nations, as in the case of famine-risen regions in Africa, for example. Individually, we are not capable of resolving such widespread problems. We do not have the faculties or the means to fulfill all their needs. If a large number of people were to combine their efforts, they might successfully alleviate a degree of suffering temporarily. However, we know that the solution would be short-lived as long as the cause of the problem is not treated. It is sometimes better to contribute towards projects that offer solutions to problems to prevent similar situations from reoccurring in the future. Okay? I think that's really something to think about. Because it's the whole thing of, you know, the house is on fire and putting out the fire versus preventing the house from catching on fire. So, you know, different situations, you definitely need to put out the fire. Yeah? But other situations, better let's keep it from catching on fire to start with. Okay. For all these reasons, the decision not to give money to a charity does not imply a transgression of the Bodhisattva precept. Okay. Now, what about you get something, somebody asks you for something, and you feel like, you know they have somebody else that they can ask, yeah. But you also feel like, geez, you know, why are they asking me? Ask somebody else. This is something that I have, and I really want to hang on to it. Then what? Then what?
Miserliness is up.
Miserliness is up, right? Have you completed a full transgression? No. Yeah. Have you completed part of a transgression?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So there's some kind of, you know, clinging on our part. Okay. So even though we may not commit a full transgression, it's very good for us to notice the different ways that clinging and miserliness arise in our mind. Yeah. Now, you might wonder about, well, how can somebody be stingy about the Dharma? Yeah. Well, I guess it happens that, you know, as far as I've heard it described, is that, you know, some people don't want to give somebody else a teaching because then that person will be capable of teaching it themselves. and then there'll be competition. Okay? In the same way that sometimes you don't want to give something, someone some material good, because then they'll have it and you won't, or they'll get the respect for having it and you won't. Yeah. So I guess the same could be, you know, in terms of teachings. So not wanting to help somebody. That's a pretty rotten motivation, isn't it? Yeah. Now, what about if somebody asks for a teaching that's way above their head? Then is it what is it if you say no? Yeah, maybe better to say no. Yeah. I remember one time, Kyamchi Sung Rinpoche was in Dharamsala, and I went to see him, and I asked him some question about emptiness, and he looked at me, and he said, "You wouldn't understand the answer even if I explained it to you." And then he proceeded for, I don't know how long, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, whatever, to talk about emptiness. So I don't know what happened, but... yeah. Okay, then the third one, Chandragaman says, not listening to others, although they apologize, and out of anger, striking others. Okay? So the third major transgression of the Bodhisattva precepts is double. The first consists of not forgiving the people who have wronged us, of yielding to our anger towards them, of refusing their apology, and verbally abusing them. Once we are overcome with wrath, the second aspect involves physically abusing the person concerned. This is really unbecoming for a bodhisattva, isn't it? This transgression, therefore, takes two forms: refusal of an apology and physical mistreatment. Both have the same underlying cause, giving into and maintaining angry feelings within us, which is where the fault actually lies. In the first case, overwhelmed with anger, we are led to refuse their apology and to assault them verbally by covering them with insults, for example. When that is not enough to relieve our anger, we attack them physically, strike them, beat them, or tie them up or have them incarcerated. Yeah? Now, before we go on here, have any of you ever received an apology and not forgiven the person? You ever had a person come to you and really sincerely, genuinely say, "I'm sorry," and you say, "Well, I'm not going to forgive you. I don't accept that apology," no matter how sincere they are? Some people say yes, some people say no.
It wasn't like that. Yeah. I think it was more, "I don't believe you."
Mm-hmm. Well, that could be part of it. You know, they might be sincere. Yeah. They look sincere. But we're so angry that we can't see the sincerity.
Yeah.
So that's included here. They might be very, very sincere. But we're so angry that anything they say, anything they do, we completely refuse to accept their apology. Yeah? Can happen, can't it? Yeah? And then we're really holding on to a grudge tremendously. Yeah? It's like, I want to get back at them for what they did to me. Mm-hmm. So they come and apologize? You have other places to seek your water. This is not the only site. Yeah. Oh, it's not filled up enough, I see. You have to stick your nose in, so it's not good enough for you. Sorry, sweetie. Okay. Yeah, so we could be so mad that we're really holding a grudge, you know. We want to retaliate. And then, yeah, even the person, you know, we want them to admit their fault. So even they come and admit their fault, we want to rub it in. You know, oh, so you finally got it, how much you hurt me? You didn't realize it at the time. You just took your liberty and then this and this and this and this. And your apology is just total BS. You know, why'd you do this in the first place? I'm never going to forgive you. Yeah. I mean, you watch when you watch on TV and in the movies, this is the context of the thing, so it has some relationship with real life. Okay. So in both cases, the object of our wrath must be a fellow human being, someone who is capable of understanding what we say. For the first aspect of the transgression, refusing an apology, the objects are people who have harmed us in some way and have later come to regret their deed and earnestly wish to express their contrition in the form of an apology. Their sincerity is important. We often say sorry automatically without really thinking of what we're saying. Frequently, it's a mere reflex. But in the present context, the apology must come straight from the heart and be motivated by a genuine wish to make amends for a wrong. And people do apologize like that. They come to realize that they did something that was unbecoming or damaging, and they regret it. In addition, it must be presented in the right time and the right way. People who wish to excuse themselves must not do it in an ill-considered and careless fashion. They should take into account the time and place and present their apology with a respectful attitude in accordance with tradition and social customs. Okay, so it's just not a, you know, and by the way, I'm sorry I stole your wife. You know, it's, you know, it's a very sincere thing and not just, you know, something you say to somebody when you're walking by, you know, or when there's a bunch of other people around so that they can't really consider what you're doing and all. Oh, I see. Okay.
You are demonstrating what you're saying.
Yeah. But she's very forgiving of her, I think. Yeah, very forgiving. Yeah. So choosing the right time for our activities is invariably important. This I find quite interesting. In the secondary precepts, the choice of the appropriate place and occasion is frequently stressed. It is perfectly logical. For example, if people are very annoyed with us and still under sway of anger, there's no point in trying to seek their forgiveness, for they will not listen. True, isn't it? Somebody's still really mad? No point in apologizing yet. Offering our apologies, in fact, will most likely have the opposite effect to the one we were seeking. Far from pardoning us, they will probably become even more furious than before. It is also unfitting to try and excuse ourselves when a person is very busy or engrossed in some other activity. We need to choose a moment when the person has the time to listen to us and would be willing to do so. We can see that the instructions for bodhisattva practice are very pragmatic and can concern situations we encounter daily. Using them can greatly improve the quality of our lives and help those around us. By following these guidelines, we will be better equipped to deal with the large variety of circumstances. We will relate to others in a way that will create greater harmony and ultimately benefit society at large. So here he's talking about not only place and timing regarding when we apologize, but also when we do anything. Yeah? Because lots of times the person is involved in doing something else, they're involved in thinking something else, they're involved in going somewhere, and we just grab them and say whatever we need to say without, you know, any concern for what their situation is. Yeah? So, you know, we do that lots of times in our life, and it leads to a lot of feelings of, you know, tension between people, because it's not actually something unethical. We're not lying or stealing or whatever, but we're just being very, you know, inconsiderate, because we want to say something and, you know, we want the answer, we want to get it off our chest or whatever it is, and it doesn't matter, you know, what's going on with the other person. So I'm thinking, I'm seeing that he's saying here, you know, in all the situations in our life, to really think, you know, when is the right time to say this, and where is the right place to say it, and how is the right way to say it, you know, instead of just, you know. Yeah, this happens at the Abbey a lot, actually, you know, and people are in the middle of doing something. Yeah, we won't go into it, but, you know, it happens a lot. And so it can be very disturbing. So really being, you know, when being considerate of others is at the fore of our mind, then we really think, you know, right time, right place, right method. Yeah. And then it always turns out better if we do. It's like, remember when you were a teenager and you wanted to ask your parents permission for something? Remember? We always were very considerate of the right time, the right place, the right words, you know? Yeah, we didn't rush it or hurry it, you know? We kind of waited for the right thing, buttered our parents up, and then asked for what we wanted. Hmm? True, isn't it? Okay. But then, you know, when there's other situations, when we just, you know, want something quickly, then we just do it, you know, any old way, and it's likely to create a not very good energy with the other person. Yeah. Whereas when we're considerate, it creates a much better energy. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we got our parents to do things for us because we knew how to ask in the right way. I'm not saying we should make it a practice of buttering people up. Okay. The first aspect of the transgression, therefore, involves continuing to harbor bad feelings and resentment and refusing to accept apologies that are offered properly at a suitable time. There may be several steps to the process of rejection. First of all, we decide not to accept them. Then we make our decision known, for example, saying, here it's very sweet. No, I cannot pardon you for what you have done. You know, no, I don't think that's going to come. We're angry. It's like, are you out of your beep, beep, beep mind? I am never going to forget this. Yeah. Or saying what you did is unforgivable and will not be easy to make up for. We're not going to be that sweet. We're going to use a lot of swear words. And, you know, really let it know that they had absolutely no business doing what they did. They're so selfish, the scum of the earth, and what they did is totally inexcusable. And any idiot knows that. So why are they even asking us for an apology? Yeah, I mean, we really rub it in and humiliate the person tremendously. Yeah. Have you ever apologized to somebody and had them not accept your apology? Yeah. What was that like? Very painful. Yeah. So then when we flip it, when we don't accept somebody else's apology, it's the same kind of thing. All the while, we continue to relentlessly bear a grudge against the person who is asking for forgiveness. If we continue to feed our anger instead of letting it go, we may very well be led to commit the second aspect of the transgression, which is physical abuse of various sorts. Yeah. Are you crazy? whatever it is. So the motivation of the transgression is resentment, the fact of holding a grudge. Someone may make us very angry by speaking to us in a way that we find offensive, for example, and instead of forgetting the incident, we brood over it. Keeping it foremost in our mind, we prolong our feelings of anger. Any of you doing that in your meditation during retreat? Going through things that have happened in the past? Ooh, how dare they do that? You know, having a nice focus, concentration, no distraction, you know. Bodhisattva doesn't intrude at all. Lunch doesn't intrude at all. Nothing intrudes. You're 100%. And, oh, they did this to me. I was so hurt. Who says we can't concentrate? Okay, any questions so far? Yeah. Yeah, if you've taken the Bodhisattva precepts before, yeah, then it's you should take them every morning and every evening. You can use any of the prayers to do so. Even the prayer that we do at the beginning, I take refuge until I'm enlightened by the merit I create by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices. May I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of others. When you do that, you can be visualizing the Buddha in the space in front of you and light coming from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and think, you know, I'm retaking the Bodhisattva vow.
So it's not like saying like that, like the whole vow?
No. The reciting the vows is another thing. Yeah, mm-hmm. Taking them is through one prayer, and there's long, you know, shorter verses and longer verses in which you say, I'm making a commitment to practice the deeds of a bodhisattva.
So then it's generating the awakening mind itself, it's like taking them every day. And
yeah.
Just, mm-hmm.
Yeah, not just generating the awakening mind, but really making the determination to follow the conduct of a bodhisattva. To engage in the deeds of a bodhisattva. Okay. Yeah.
I'm wondering if is it that you have to refuse the apology, or what if you're like processing it and you can't really accept it or refuse it?
Mm-hmm. In other words, so you're asking you. You're not really refusing it, but you can't accept it, and you need some time to think about it.
Yeah, like if you know that if a person comes to you and you're angry or hurt still, which is under whatever is underlying the anger, is still there. Mm-hmm. You haven't really worked that out in your mind, and you can't really accept it because you're not. That's in your mind, so you can't usually see their sincerity then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're saying that you're really still actively holding on to anger, yeah, even though somebody's apologizing to you.
Yeah, but
you're
not so on top of it.
Yeah, that's the thing. You're not on top of it. And that's how this gets transgressed, because we're not on top of it. And we're not willing at that moment to say to ourselves, oh, I need to really consider this and try and let it go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we're saying to ourselves, oh my goodness, they apologized. I thought that this would never happen in my whole life. You know, I've never even thought about letting this go because I never thought they'd apologize. And here they are apologizing. You know, there you may not be completely, you know, free of your anger yet, but you're really going in that direction and you're appreciating their apology. But when you're still hanging on to it with so much resentment that you can't really take their apology in, then it's refusing the apology.
Uh-huh. And what happens is, for example, who might have apologized to you, but was like me. And I was very angry at that moment. And I didn't. I refused to accept the apology.
The apology.
But after the time, I didn't get to apologize.
Right.
But this person doesn't know it. And I feel that forever that...
Okay, so at the time when you couldn't accept their apology, that was a, you know, that's not accepting the apology, okay? And then later when you change your mind, you know, and you really feel grateful to them, they don't know that you have, it would be nice to contact them and let them know that you changed your mind and that you really appreciate their apology after all. I'm sure that would make a big difference to the other person. I think you should still do some more purifying. Yeah. Because you want to make sure you don't do it again, because part of the thing is putting the habitual tendency in your mind to do it again. So I think you need to do more than just later decide to accept it, but, you know, actively try and remind yourself to accept apologies.
I find it interesting that this hinges on apologies. I mean, wouldn't it be better not to hold grudges regardless of getting an apology?
Yes. And I think that's what in some way it's pointing to. This precept isn't saying that you hold the grudge until the person apologizes. Oh, now, finally! You've gotten your wits and you've apologized. I accept it. You know, no, but actually, you know, that we should be working on our anger all the time and trying to release whatever anger there is, so that we can forgive the person whether or not they apologize. And if we do that, then if they do come and apologize, you know, then it's very easy to accept it because we've already worked on it ourselves and, you know, we forgive the person.
Actually, the wording of the one that's in the succession I use, it's not forgiving though someone apologizes. So my mind has always been not forgiving, even if they apologize. So I see that that's not what Dabo Rinpoche says, but it holds it in a kind of different light. Mm-hmm. It's like not forgiving is the transgression. Even if they apologize is sort of the tag on.
I mean, that's
kind of the way it's been in my head, because that's the way it's written.
Yeah. But in some way, that's what it's getting at.
It is what's happening.
The real transgression occurs when they apologize and refuse it. But the thing it's getting at is not forgiving and holding on to the anger in any situation. Yeah. And especially if somebody's apologizing. Okay. Yeah. If it's a root pratimoksha and you break it with all the parts complete, then you lose it.
So what is a root pratimoksha?
Well, for the it's not important for you to know that in terms of the monks and nuns' vows. In terms of the five lay precepts, they would be killing and intentionally killing a human being, who dies before you and so on, and then stealing something that does not belong to you in any way, and that is of the amount that the government would get involved, the legal system would get involved, and then taking it and making it your own and really delighting at that. And the third one, the unwise and unkind sexual conduct is principally if you're in a relationship going outside of that relationship, or even if you're not in a relationship going with somebody who is in one. Okay, and then the lying one is particularly lying about your spiritual attainments. And then for the one of intoxicants is not a root one. So if you drink intoxicants, you don't lose your five lay precepts. With the five lay precepts, if you break it from the root, many teachers will let you retake them. Yeah. But with the monastic vows, we're finished. There's no possibility. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that's as far as we got. But it gives us a lot to think about, huh?